how we want to see if we can lose ourselves somewhere in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and essentially take up on aspects of...
As I'll say when we start, we'd like to focus more on the technical side.
Yeah.
Okay.
Away we go.
Right. This is Jeffrey Sturcio, and we're interviewing Dr. Arnold Beckman for the Center for History of Chemistry today, April 23rd, 1985, in Smith Hall at the University of Pennsylvania. With me are Arnold Thackeray, director of the center, and Eric Elliott. Dr. Beckman, from the oral history memoir on deposit at Caltech, from the ACS Eminent Chemist videotape series, and the discussion in Golden Past, Golden Future, the 50th anniversary history of Beckman instruments, we're relatively well informed on your childhood interest in chemistry, excited by Steele's 14 weeks, your early education, your tour of duty in the Marines, and your decision then to go to back to the University of Illinois. And in today's session, what we'd like to do is focus on your career beginning at the University of Illinois, leading up through the end of World War II, with an emphasis on the technical side. But before we started Urbana in the fall of 1919, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about your experience working as an industrial chemist while still a teenager, first for the gas works in, I believe it was Bloomington, Illinois, and then later for the Keystone Iron and Steel Works in Pekin, Illinois.
Yes, as you know, I went to University High School, which is part of the then Illinois State Normal University, and I was permitted to take some university chemistry courses in lieu of Latin, and the professor in charge of the university chemistry was Howard W. Adams, and he was indeed a great friend of mine, and he encouraged me to set up a little laboratory in my home to analyze the chips in the local gas company that were used to absorb hydrogen sulfide. These are iron oxide coated chips, so that I had a little laboratory in the corner of my home which I performed this analysis.
That's where I began my industrial career too, in fact, doing the same problem, town gas and iron oxide analysis. Yes.
And that did the gasworks just farm all their analyses out to you, or were there other people who did this? Was it normal, or was it something that was characteristic?
I suspect that Professor Adams had something to do with seeing that I got some orders on that, because he was very helpful to me in many ways.
Was he also? Do you think he was also behind the job that you got at Keystone Iron and Steelworks just before you graduated from high school?
He may well have been. I'm kind of. Yes, I wouldn't be surprised, because this involved being excused from school early to engage in war work. You see, I started the Keystone Steel and Iron Works so March or April, something like that, of 1918, 2 or 3 months before the close of the year, and that would have required approval of the school authorities, so undoubtedly he was involved in that.
And you mentioned when you were interviewed for Caltech that you were doing chemical analyses of molten steel to find out the percentage of carbon and silicon, sulfur, and sometimes manganese, and phosphorus. I was just wondering what sort of apparatus did they have available? Was there a plant laboratory, or was this just something?
Oh, yes. They had a regular analytical with the Alberine stone tabletops on there and the analytical balances. And the procedure was that the chemist would go over to the open hearth furnace with a little mold and reach in and get a sample of the molten iron, put it in the mold, and then with the tongs carry it back to the lab while it was still hot, and then quench it enough so we could handle it, and then drill it out, make some drilling for chips on there, weigh these out on the four different samples for the four tests, make on the analytical balance, weigh them out, of course, by hand, and then carry them through in the proper sequence. As I recall, I got to the speed where I could run all four analyses in 30 minutes.
What did they do then with the information that came from the analyses? Oh, did they then try to tinker with
that? That determined mix? Whether or not the melt was ready to pour. Mm-hmm. See, when you have 100 tons of steel on there. It's very important, and the minutes are important on there too. So they'd wait until the lab results are there, and the man would run back and either tell him to carry on or else to pour it.
And were there, how many chemists, were you in competition with other chemists to try and...
Not at the same shift. Yeah, we had only one per shift. Yeah.
I see. So, and there were, what, two shifts, three shifts?
So we worked two shifts, alternate 10 and 14-hour shifts, 2 weeks on one shift and 2 weeks on the other.
So would you say that Keystone was advanced in using chemists for this kind of process analysis, or was that something that was coming into more widespread use?
Oh, I think it was standard practice at that time for open hearth furnaces.
Though not very standard practice to be early graduate from high school.
Oh, no. No, I imagine that not very many high school students had that opportunity.
And this presumably did reinforce your enthusiasm for chemistry.
Yes. Well, I enjoyed it very much. Of course, on the long shifts, we had periods when there wasn't much for us to do, waiting for things. I remember stretching out on these cold Alberine stone top and taking a nap until it was time to go over and collect the sample.
Well, that's so you stayed there for through the summer, I believe.
Yes.
Until you enlisted.
I think I enlisted in the Marines in early August.
And then you told us the story of how you how you met your wife while you were in the Marines, and then had a chance to apply for a discharge and were discharged at the end of January 1919 or so.
That's right.
And then you went out west, spent some time in Ashton, Idaho, and elsewhere, and that's all discussed in the Caltech interview. But by the fall of 1919, you were back at the University of Illinois and had started in on your undergraduate training there. And I'd like to focus on a few aspects of that to try and fill out the outline of the years that you spent at Illinois. For one thing, you mentioned in the Eminent Chemist videotape with the ACS that at the time you thought you wanted to be an organic chemist to synthesize dyes and other organic compounds like that. And I was just wondering what the attitude was in the chemical community about the American chemical industry. We know about the attempt to build up the American chemical industry at the time, and I just wondered what discussions there were, what people were reading, whether they were talking about those issues at Illinois in 1919.
Keep in mind, I was a young lad of 19, coming from a small rural community, had no contact with the industrial world at all, so I really am not in a position to tell you what the average thinking was. I wasn't worried about the future of the chemical industry at that time. I was interested in making some interesting chemical dyes or things that smell well or things like that. You know? The other, I'm sure there must have been great concern from the demand for chemical engineers. At that time, they commanded the highest starting salaries of graduates, for example. That, again, is one indication of the interest in the future of chemistry.
What about the people who went to Illinois with you? That was a very unusual moment in all sorts of ways, not least in people returning from the war. But were there other freshmen who'd had the sort of chemical experience that you had had?
I don't recall anybody that had other than just the normal high school training. No.
In the Illinois Chemist, there were a number of editorials on the tension between the chemists and the chemical engineers at Illinois, and whether there should be a College of Chemistry. And I wonder if you would tell us a bit about that and the background to those discussions.
Well, obviously we were very much concerned about whether we could be honored by being elected into Phi Beta Kappa or Tau Beta Pi. And we were excluded from both by being in between. And the chemical engineering was actually part of the College of Liberal Arts. But the Phi Beta wouldn't accept chemical engineers as being suitable material for it. And the engineering school wouldn't accept us as being, not really engineers. They thought of us as chemists. The chemical engineer was just a chemist with a pipe wrench. That was the attitude there. Of course, at that time, whether or not you had a pin or so to wear was a very important part of a person's life.
And did you write those editorials in the Illinois Chemist?
Apparently I did, yes.
But what's intriguing about them, for instance, in one of the editorials, you refer to the example of MIT and the School of Chemical Engineering Practice. So clearly there was
MIT. Yes.
You know, there was information about what was going on at MIT and elsewhere in the Illinois department.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could tell us a bit about the faculty you worked with. You mentioned that you studied with Dietrichsen and Rodebusch. I wonder if we could start with Dietrichsen and your work with him as his lab assistant.
Well, I started, of course, with C.S. Marble, Carl S. Marble, in my freshman year. And because I'd had this extra chemistry during high school, I was allowed to omit the regular freshman chemistry.
You can't do the arithmetic. How old was he at that moment?
Speed Marble, he was about, he's 91, I think. He's about 5 or 6 years older than me.
He must have been about 25.
He was just feeling his wings as an instructor.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Yes. What was Speed Marble like in those days?
Oh, he was a very, very likable person, friendly, and he commanded the respect of everybody. First of all, from his knowledge and competence, and also from his general behavior. He was a great fellow.
Was he playing poker in those days?
I presume so. I was not in the poker playing crowd. He and Roger Adams, I know, had a reputation for that.
And shortly after that, when you contracted mercury poisoning, working on those mercury compounds for Speed Marble, you switched over into physical chemistry and started to work then with Rodebusch. And we have here in the Illinois Chemist a little description of thermodynamics Rodebusch. And I wonder if you'd tell us a little bit about your relationship with him and what he was like.
Well, he came to Illinois from Berkeley, the University of California, Berkeley, and he had a reputation of being a tough professor. You really had to come up with good, solid, well-reasoned answers if you're going to get favorable reports from him. He was aloof, kept himself a little bit aloof. He was not like Speed Marble. Speed Marble was one of the gang, so if the Rodebusch, I never felt was quite like that, more reserved.
But did you took his courses in physical chemistry,
oh, yes.
I guess? And he had worked with G.N. Lewis at Berkeley,
yes.
And this was really the cutting edge of research in thermodynamics and physical chemistry at the time,
right.
So... what did you feel about the kind of stuff that you were learning in Rodebusch's classes and your other courses?
Well, I thought it was interesting and worthwhile when you mentioned thermodynamics. So I've had three types of thermodynamics. Under Rodebusch, I had the chemical thermodynamics. Then I was in engineering. I had Goodenough thermodynamics, steam engines and things like that, you know. And when I went out to Caltech, got thrown in with some physicists like Fritz Zwicky, I got the physicist concept of thermodynamics. So I really had a lot of exposure to thermodynamics.
And with how did you start to work with Dietrichsen then? That was just an assignment for a teaching assistant?
Yes, he had, well, and also the White, T.A. White, was doing some research on the thermodynamic properties of aqueous ammonia solutions, and so he needed research assistance, so I started in with that. Then Dietrichsen gave me a job as a helper and assistant in the course in electrochemistry. This, I look back, also as a factor of dialing my career, because I did gain some first-hand experience with making standard cells and calomel half cells and hydrogen electrode, things of that sort. So maybe that was a factor also in Glenn Joseph coming to me. See, he knew that I had worked with hydrogen ion determination at Illinois. I hadn't thought about that, but that undoubtedly was a factor that hadn't come to me.
Had Glenn Joseph been doing similar kind of work at Illinois, or was he in a different field entirely?
No, a different field. He was what we call him now, more of a biochemist.
Also at Illinois at the time, and let me just ask about some of the other faculty, because one would have thought that the Arnold Beckman who would later found Beckman Instruments might have been in contact with them. And let's just see if you had had any contact with people like Samuel Parr, who was near retirement.
Yes,
but was
he was quite a famous chemist at the time I was there. He was the Parr calorimeter, for example, the standard instrument over there. And he was an older person then and highly respected. He wasn't active very long after I left, as I recall. But I recall going through the standard course on using the Parr calorimeter. And, of course, then there was W.A. Noyes Sr. I took organic chemistry lectures from him. And as you pointed out earlier, this is after World War I. The World War had a great effect on him. And I appreciated lectures because he would bring in something more than organic chemistry. He'd bring in philosophy of living. And he was very much affected by the war with Germans because he had many friends in Germany. And he would wander off into philosophical discussions in his lectures about unfortunate aspects of human character that permit them to generate hatred and to fight each other, things that sort. So I got a lot out of his lectures other than just some knowledge of organic chemistry.
To go back for a moment to Samuel Parr, who really had been the essential founder of the Illinois department, and his calorimeter had a very wide use in its day. The utility of that calorimeter, its general acceptance in the chemical community, is something that that you would automatically be aware of.
Well, it was the method. As I recall, there wasn't any really competing method of that. We just accepted it.
And he was a sort of elder statesman in the department.
Yes, his elder statesman at that time, yes.
Had Donald Keyes arrived when you were still there?
No. He may have come in the last year, but at least I didn't know him there.
And also in industrial chemistry was G. Frederick Smith, I believe.
Oh, yes. Well, I wouldn't call him an industrial chemist. He was an analytical chemist who got involved in a successful chemical business. We used to call him G. Frederick, or we used to call him perchlorate Smith, because he made perchloric acid and perchlorates and things like that, as you know. And he's a very jovial person, full of jokes. And he also then developed he was one of the inventors of the what we call an aerosol type of dispensing of cream. And he's that time he was involved in quite a bit of litigation. As I recall, he had a patent that used nitrous oxide as the aerosol, and he used carbon dioxide, something like that, that had enough pH and it'll curdle the milk and cream like that. So nitrous oxide had some advantages. As I recall, he was involved in litigation for several years before I think his patents were finally sustained.
Statement and the linking with Parr does point to a sort of style of doing chemistry that was very different from, say, Johns Hopkins, which was much more academic with a capital A. And did you were Illinois people? Were you very aware that Illinois was different? Was that?
Illinois, I'd say, was more of a down-to-earth practical school. For example, did a lot of agricultural chemistry. That was a big part of it. We used to do soil analyses and water analyses for the citizens of the state. And had a special division in there just doing that. So that, yes, it was much more oriented practical uses than Johns Hopkins was.
Did students get drawn into that at all?
Because they had specific courses in these various things out here. I forgot what the course was called. Now that involved running calorimetric methods, but that was part of the standard training for at least chemical engineering students. I think for chemistry students also.
Well, and the industrial connections certainly were evident to students at the time. Here's another issue of the Illinois Chemist with an editorial on the chemist and the business world, in which the editor undoubtedly argued that it was important for students to know something about business, since students who were successful in chemistry in the industrial world were going to need to know more than chemistry.
Well, I have to accept credit or blame for these things. I'd be real surprised as I read them now. No?
It's a very prescient article.
I'd hold to that.
How did you get into the Illinois Chemist? We should ask you a little bit more about that.
I really don't know. I was active in Alpha Chi Sigma at that time, and maybe through some of that connection that I really don't know how I first started that.
Well, it's certainly, before long you had ads from Central Scientific and a number of other companies, and what sort of response did it get from the alumni and from the faculty and students?
Well, the thing was financially in the black. I don't think it made any money, but at least it did carry itself. Primarily from advertising rather than from sales to the students.
There was, are you the one, or do you recall recruiting Rodebush to write on the physical chemist in industry?
Probably I did that, yes. That was my job. Rodebush and B.S. Hopkins and the others that wrote the different articles in there.
As long as we're on the subject of the Illinois Chemist and the student body, I wonder if we might ask you about some of the other chemists or the other students who were at Illinois at the time. Glenn Joseph will come up again, since you had a very important encounter with him later on. But your class included Wallace Reed Broad, who went on to become a Guggenheim Fellow at Leipzig and eventually president of the ACS.
Yes.
And Clifford Rassweiler, who worked for DuPont for many years, became a president of the ACS. Do you recall having dealings with them or any of your other classmates?
Yes, Wallace Broad, he was one of triplets, as you may recall.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in spectrophotometry, so I had a lot to do later on with Wallace Broad in that field. Cliff Rassweiler, I had no direct technical connection, but I saw him quite often at Chemical Society meetings and things like that. I knew him very well.
Were they fraternity brothers of yours at Illinois, or do you recall?
Not social fraternity. I imagine they were both members of Alpha Chi Sigma, because most of the active chemists were at that time.
Just talk about the fraternities, the chemical fraternity and social fraternities. Were you in both these worlds? Or?
Oh, yes. I lived in the Delta Upsilon, the house, the DU house. Mm-hmm. That was the social fraternity, so I lived there. And Alpha Chi Sigma then had its own house. Of course, then we had the honorary fraternity, Phi Delta Upsilon. And also that's Sigma Xi, another one I'm trying to think of. Another honorary fraternity for graduates only.
Was that Tau Beta Phi?
No. Gamma Phi. This may have been a local for Illinois, as far as I know, but that may come to me now. Mm-hmm.
The just to stay with these sorts of worlds, the Illinois student body in chemistry was small enough that you would sort of know all the names of the other freshmen, sophomore, juniors, or
I would know many of them. I'm not sure I'd know all of them, because it was a sizable department then. But
did some of the other people who must have been on campus at the time were, for instance, John Johnson and Wallace Carruthers?
Yes, Jack Johnson. He went from Illinois to Cornell. He was an outstanding. He was one of my teachers too at there, right? Yeah. Outstanding organic. And the other was
Carruthers.
Wallace Carruthers, and he went to DuPont from Bennett and Nylon. Dr. DeVigno, do you have his name down there?
D.R. DeVigno.
Went to Cornell Medical School. He won a Nobel Prize later for that. Yes, I recall him well.
Did you have much contact with people like DeVigno and Carruthers at Illinois, or was it?
Well, I didn't work with them in the laboratory, but of course, in frequent seminars and things like that, we had hobnob and got acquainted with each other.
How about Samuel McElvain, who later went to Wisconsin? He was class of 21.
I don't recall him so well. The name is vaguely familiar, but I don't recall anything special about him.
And then the year you got your master's, well, you mentioned Bill Hinckley, William Hinckley, who went to Caltech with you. R.L. Schreiner got his master's the same time you did. And was later on
We saw him later on, of course, when he came back to Illinois.
And C.D. Graves, who got his Ph.D. that year, went to DuPont to work with Carruthers.
I don't remember Graves.
And Albert Elder, who was...
That name is familiar. But I don't recall what he looked like. But that name is familiar.
To get back to the fraternity question, and having mentioned some of the other people who were there, and you also said that you would see them at colloquium lectures, reading again through the Illinois Chemist, it's clear that the chemical fraternities would have visiting professors for an evening or of talks, or Roger Adams might give a lecture on Mellon fellowships and things. How big a part of social life within the department was that? And how important do you think it was to Illinois chemists and their later careers to have that kind of exposure?
Well, you'd have to divide the students into two groups. Those chemists that lived in the Alpha Chi Sigma house, and these, I recall, had 30 or 40, something like that, living in the house. This would be a big part of it. Those who lived in social fraternity houses, it was nowhere near as big as that.
And you, which group were you in?
I lived in the Delta Upsilon house, yes.
One other question that I had about Illinois, you've given us some interesting background on some of the other aspects of it, but you said it, I believe, in the Caltech interview, that you also had offers to go to MIT in Chicago when it got time to go to graduate school and decided, as we know, to go to Caltech. Do you recall what it was that attracted you, either MIT or Chicago, at the time?
Oh, they were the recognized top schools in the field of chemistry and chemical engineering, yes.
Did one of your professors steer you toward any one of the three?
No, I think when the time came to apply, I just sent out several requests for admission. That was it. I don't recall any professor pushing any particular university, except to say Tolma did... mentioned the advantages of Caltech being a small school, and also, as I mentioned earlier, I think that the attraction of the state of California as such played a role. I was young and curious to see what this fabled land was like.
You didn't... what about staying at Illinois as an option? Were you sort of...
That was an option, but there was a feeling often expressed that a student should change schools, not have all of his training in one school. And this is something that philosophy that faculty carried at Caltech. We urged even our good students, even though we had to lose them, to go somewhere else, get a different view, because that was a part of the thing.
So in the, this would be the fall of 1923 then, after your trip out west with William Hinckley, you ended up at Caltech. And as you said before, it was Tolman, partly it was Tolman going to Caltech at the time that leaned you in that direction. And Tolman's style of physical chemistry or even chemical physics was something that was more aligned with Lewis's school at Berkeley. You had contacts with Rodebush, who'd come from that school. What was Caltech like, and what sort of things did you do that first year?
Well, I taught freshman chemistry, for which I was paid, and then took the usual courses. The chemists at that time had to take quite a bit of physics. Say, this is when quantum theory was in its very controversial stage, and I know we had our text was Arnold Sommerfeld's Atom Bau, which we had to read in German, which is bad enough for itself, particularly Arnold Sommerfeld's style was not particularly clear, and try to get this controversial quantum theory, so that was a tough job. People like Pauling like to go through it, but I know I had a struggle with the biggest. But it was exciting. And we had visitors, of course. Einstein was there, and Sommerfeld himself was there. Heisenberg came in, and Bohr, the real chief actors in the drama, visited Caltech. This undoubtedly was due to the preeminence of Millikan and Hale, plus noise, and noise, plus noise emphasis on, if we're going to be in a discipline, we want to be second to none. So they went out of their way to bring these leaders out there so the students could be exposed to them.
And you referred in an earlier interview to the atmosphere at Caltech being very intimate between graduate students and
yeah.
faculty because of the size of the institute.
That's still the situation.
And how was, could you talk a little about the contrast between Illinois and Caltech in that first year, in addition to these luminaries coming to visit? But what other differences did you find?
Well, you have to keep in mind when I 21 years old, I looked up to any professor with a good deal of awe. If I got a little older, some of that awe diminished. But nevertheless, when I went to Caltech, I remember